Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thank you so much for tuning in for a brand new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. My guest today, former BYU football player and former BYU football radio sideline reporter, he is the great Nate Mickle. Nate, it is so good to be able to talk with you. How are you?
Jason, doing so good. So happy to be here with you guys. I love Lawrence, Kansas, especially because you guys are coming out here now frequently. We just had dinner together a couple weeks ago. You're coming out next week. Just loving life in Lawrence, Kansas.
So you mentioned it. You're in Lawrence. You're at KU. Give everybody an update on what you're doing there.
Yeah, so I got offered a position in the business school to teach leadership and ethics, and it's a tenure-track position, so I'm in the business school. I have 6 years to get tenure. If I get tenure, I can stay forever. If I don't get tenure, they fire me. I got to find another job. I'm doing research in social psychology, organizational behavior. I do research on judgment and decision-making, and I attend a lot of sporting events because KU basketball is awesome. It's the birthplace of basketball in the sense that James Naismith was the first basketball coach at the University of Kansas. When you walk down the main drag here in Lawrence, it's called Mass Street. It's where they've got all these independently owned restaurants, and it's where people hang out after the games. And on Mass Street, you'll see lots of T-shirts that will say, Lawrence, Kansas, the birthplace of North Carolina basketball. So Roy Williams was here at Kansas. And then, you know, Rupp Arena, Kentucky basketball, Adolph Rupp was here. He coached under James Naismith as well, or after James Naismith. So we just love Lawrence, Kansas. Never thought we'd be here. My wife has a pin that says Kansas, maybe it's like Lawrence, Kansas, exceeding your already low expectations.
Very nice. Well, look, like this is we will get into more of the specifics, but you didn't immediately just go from leaving BYU to going to Lawrence, Kansas. There's a lot of stops in between, which we will certainly get to throughout the course of our conversation today. But you have always been focused on academics. Was it always a dream of yours to be a professor or at least work in that world?
Well, you say always focus on academics, and I have to say that isn't quite true. And my high school basketball coach would agree with you, because after I played at BYU, and what actually happened, and maybe we're jumping ahead, and we can see how we want to go from here. But I ended up going to law school, and ended up getting into Stanford, which was a whole kind of miracle, amazing story in and of itself. And when I went back to visit my high school, my basketball coach, he says, well, you know, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to law school. Where? Yeah, I'm going to Stanford. And he said, I didn't know you were smart. And so, you know, I was not known as the smart guy in high school. I was the guy that cared a lot about sports and, you know, just trying to stay eligible so that I could play sports. But at some point I had this weird shift in my life, and now I'm in this academic world and love learning, but it wasn't always the case.
Okay. So while we're in that space right now, what do you think was the change? Because obviously I covered you as a player, so I certainly had that background, but I didn't really get to know you personally until we were both part of the BYU football radio crew. And from that point on, to me, you were the former athlete, but was also super smart. Because I'm skipping ahead to so much of the interview, but I have always thought of you as such a smart guy because of all the schooling that you've done, and you just seem to just absorb knowledge. When do you think that changed for you, or maybe what was it that changed for you?
Yeah, so a couple things. I did always love to read. I always loved to learn. I was constantly learning information. I didn't care for school much. I just liked sports so much more. And actually, I mean, this is a little bit of a, I guess this provides some insight too. When I was at Snow College, and I I decided I wanted to get a 4.0. You know what? Let me even back up even further, because I think this is actually the key moment. I'm in high school. I'm trying to stay eligible. That's the goal. I had a friend who had got a dual athletic academic scholarship. And I thought, if I could do that, then I would get free school and make some money. So I set this as a goal. And I feel like this is kind of like a theme in my life where I have some doubt about myself. Then I believe, or I have a belief and then I doubt, and then I just obsess. And so I kind of got obsessed with this idea of like, what if I could get both an athletic and academic scholarship? So I go to Ricks College my freshman year, and I had been challenged to read the Book of Mormon before, you know, first thing in the morning, taking a mission prep class. And I feel like that totally changed my life. I would wake up, I would study the scriptures, and I had like this feeling of peace and calm and focus that I'd never felt before. And so all of a sudden, the energy that I had applied to sports before, I was now applying to school. And so my freshman year at Ricks, I end up getting about, I didn't quite get a 4.0, but I had like one or two A minuses. I was still learning how to study because I had never really studied. But my grades my freshman year of college were better than any of my grades in high school. And then I go on a mission, and I feel like that just kind of helps, you know, pour gasoline on the fire in terms of like, I'm just like consuming so much information. My favorite time on a mission, I mean, I love to teach and preach and all that, but I love study time in the morning. And so then I get to Snow College, and it's like, okay, if I get the 4.0, you know, I can get the athletic academic scholarship. And I would actually at times go out to practice, especially on walkthrough. Walkthrough days are boring. Walkthrough days, it's just like, you know, it's the fifth day you're running these plays, and you know, some of the guys need it more than others. My job was pretty easy. I was a running back. So it's pretty basic stuff. So I would bring my notes out and I would actually study during a walkthrough sometimes. So then I get to BYU and I cannot focus on academics as much as I want to because of football. So after graduating from BYU, I decided I wanted to go to law school. When I was at Stanford Law School, I wasn't doing sports and I was able to fully just like obsess over school. And I feel like that's where kind of another shift happened of like, okay, I really do love learning. And now I have the chance to take advantage of all the opportunities that academia education has to offer. And so that's when I decided, okay, let's just do this forever. And that kind of began the academic career.
So you mentioned Ricks, you mentioned going on your mission. You've mentioned in previous interviews that it was a difficult decision at first for you to put off football to serve a mission. What helped you change your mindset for that?
Yeah, a couple things. First, I got offered one scholarship out of high school, and it was to Ricks College. And I went and watched them play in the Reese Dairy Bowl, and I was sick to my stomach because I thought, I can't play here. I'm not good enough. They've wasted a scholarship on me. I'm going to be embarrassed. I get to Ricks and first practice, I'm first string. The two guys that could have been ahead of me were both hurt. So I'm running first string all during fall camp, and I'm making plays. And so then I think like, oh, I actually can do it. I can play here. I'm not good enough for BYU, but I can play at Ricks. And right before I think it was the last scrimmage of the season, I ran a little, I was split out wide or split out in the slot, ran a little crossing route, and I got hit and tore my PCL. And at that point, I thought my football career was over. I didn't know much about knee injuries. There's no internet where, you know, you don't have a good sense for, I didn't certainly, what these injuries meant. And I thought my football career was over. I thought it was done forever. So I was devastated. I find out my PCL is only partially torn. And so I always wanted to go on a mission. At least my hero, Nate Garn, he played at high school, played at Hillcrest before me. I still remember sitting in his homecoming talk and I felt the spirit. I was like, I want to be like him. I want to go on a mission. So I wanted to go on a mission. It's just when I got out on my mission, that's when I realized this is the hardest, worst thing I've ever done. Not the worst in the sense that I wasn't grateful I was there, but like, I just remember Saturdays walking along the streets of Antofagasta, Chile, and I'm just depressed. Like, I want to be playing football. I'm just thinking about the games. I'm thinking about my teammates. A couple things. One, I did want to go, and I did have a mission prep class that Brother Clark changed my life. You know, you read in Alma, you know, have you experienced this change of heart? And I say, yeah, I have. I liked to, you know, I tried to do well in high school. I tried to keep the commandments, but I wasn't all in. I wasn't fully committed. And then I took this religion class, this preaching the gospel class by Brother Clark, and I had that change of heart. And I just felt like, you know, can you sing the song of redeeming love? I was like, yeah, I can. I feel it. I want to share. I went to the MTC, and I remember I was skipping the basketball games, you know, gym, because I was so into the Book of Mormon. I could not stop reading the Book of Mormon. It's like Parley P. Pratt talks about how like eating was a burden and sleep was a burden. And I get to the MTC and I'm feeling that. I read the Book of Mormon in high school. I'd completed it a couple times, but I could not put it down, so much so that I was skipping gym, skipping basketball, which is like my second love to football. And it's like, okay, yeah, I do love the gospel, but it's just, it's really hard to share the gospel. It's not fun. We had a Elder Venus. He was in the First Quorum of the 70. He came and spoke to us, and I was on my mission. He said, all right, everybody, if you're having fun out here, raise your hand. And you know, like maybe 3/4 of the missionaries raise their hand. And he says, you guys are liars. He's like, this isn't fun. Surfing's fun. Basketball's fun. He's like, you think I would be here if God didn't command me to be here? No way. This is the worst. I'm only here because I'm commanded, but he did command me, so I'm here. And for me, that really rung true. Now, everybody's mission is different, and some people really do enjoy the day-to-day. And there are things about my mission. I mean, the people I met, like we could talk for hours about the different people I met and I love and I still communicate with today, and all of the, you know, it's the greatest 2 years of my life, and certainly the most impactful. But man, I was thinking about football the whole time.
Anybody that served a mission certainly knows there are going to be ups and downs just in general because of what you're doing. And for a lot of people, it's the first time away from home. So there's a lot of things that are thrown at you all at once. Besides those normal things, while you were serving, you had to deal with something else. Your mom started having really bad heart problems. Walk us through the experience that you and your family had as you went through that trial, all while you're on your mission.
Yeah, you know, in my patriarchal blessing, there was a line that said something about it was talking about my mission, and then it said, no challenge from God will be greater than you can bear. And I remember before my mission thinking like, I'm going to have to deal with some stuff on my mission. This is going to be tough. And so when I got there and I was crying every morning, when I first got there, I was like, okay, you know, this is it. This is the tough stuff. And then when I'd been out about 18 months, my mom was having heart problems, and she had a defibrillator on her heart that was trying to help regulate her heartbeat. And I get a call one day I was traveling. When I get home, there's a note on my door that says, call home. And I call home, and and they're like, and actually it wasn't even call home, because my family traveled to Salt Lake. What had happened is my mom had, what do they call it? A heart storm. And they had to life flight her to Salt Lake City, and they're using the crash pads on her. It was something like 30, 40 times. And they barely get her to Salt Lake alive. And they're like, you know, her heart's it's failing. It's full of scar tissue. Come to find out, she had giant cell myocarditis. And so it's touch and go for a couple weeks. And then one night, it's midnight, I'm asleep, and the phone rings. And I can't remember if it was my dad or my brother. And they say, here's mom. And my mom just like tells me goodbye. And she tells me she loves me, and she, you know, she's so proud of me. And then after, so I say goodbye to my mom. My brother gets on the phone and he says, they're going to turn off the machines in the morning when the doctors come in, because there's no hope. There's just nothing they can do. Then my dad gets on, and my dad is just, you know, I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't get the words out. And they say, we'll call you in the morning when she passes. So I mean, this is just, you know, like I'm shaking. My whole body's shaking. I'm in shock. I think it's maybe the only time
I've ever been. How are you supposed to focus on anything else after a conversation like that, Nate?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so now it's like 1 a.m. and I'm shaking. I can't stop shaking. And I have this thought, about, I'd read Jesus the Christ recently, and it talked about how there was this moment where basically the idea was, you know, if you love family, friends more than me, then you're not worthy of me. And there was a line in there, Elder Talmadge was talking about how when you're called on a mission, like that's the priority. And in that moment, I just felt like this is my priority. This is where my mom would want me. This is where God would want me. And then I had this like this peace. I was thinking about my mom, and this like warmth and peace came over me, and I stopped shaking. And what's really cool about this, so it's like, can't even describe this feeling of peace and calm that comes over me. And I feel like, okay, it's you know, it's going to be fine. And this scripture of like, peace will be sweet unto those that die unto the Lord, something like that. And I later, my family, I have six siblings, they all wrote journal entries about this night. And all six of them shared something similar, where they all had this overwhelming sense of peace and warmth and comfort. And I was literally thinking about this a couple nights ago, like, you know, how does a scientist explain that? How does an atheist or somebody who doesn't believe in God, how do they explain that? Like, is that a natural response to shock? Is that you automatically, like, your body recovers by feeling a warmth and a peace that is like the perfect description of the Holy Ghost? I think that's a tough explanation for an atheist. Like, I mean, I can't explain it other, like, to me, it was the Spirit, you know, like it was God comforting me. So I wake up in the morning, I'm waiting for the phone call. It doesn't come. A couple hours go by, doesn't come. I remember I was playing soccer, trying to do anything to not think of it, get home expecting the phone call to have been there, doesn't come. And I end up talking to my family later that night, and they're like, she turned the corner. She's doing a little better somehow. Maybe there's a chance she could get a heart transplant, but it's such a long shot. A day later, she gets on the heart transplant list. She had a heart 48 hours later in her body, new heart. It was the fastest anybody had ever been on a heart transplant list and got a heart transplant. And my mom lived another 20 years. Like, it was just the greatest miracle. And, you know, I just can't believe that she's, you know, to have to say goodbye to a parent and then get another couple decades with them is, for me, it's like, you know, greatest gift of my life.
When you go from one moment thinking you had just had the final conversation on this earth with your mom to then realizing she's going to make it, and then you get home and have a chance to give her a hug after your mission is over, what was that moment like for you?
Yeah, we have pictures of it. And I mean, I'm getting choked up thinking about it. And I can see the picture. And I mean, both of us are just, you know, our eyes are just bright red. And, you know, it's just like so much gratitude and so much love. And my mom, she ended up passing away just a couple of days before Christmas. And she is the most angelic, sweetest, most service-oriented people who have ever lived. And nobody outside, like in terms of world status, she essentially has zero. Nobody knows her outside of her family and friends and ward members and community, but everybody who knows her, I mean, talk about just somebody that touches everyone's life for good. So I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk about her. I didn't know we were going to go this route. I didn't know you knew that about my mission. But the airport in Idaho Falls and just being able to see her again and she had a whole journey too, because she had to live in Salt Lake for several months after the heart transplant. And so it was this competition to see who was going to get to Idaho first, if she would be able to move back home before I got home, and she just beat me. And so it was just so incredible to be able to see her again. And, you know, maybe like a glimpse of, you know, I have faith we live again. I have faith there's a heaven. I have faith there's an afterlife. And so a glimpse of what the afterlife will be like.
What an unbelievable faith building experience. And thank you, by the way, for being willing to share that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into you finally making your way to Provo, and the BYU football team. We will take a quick break. We will have more with Nate Mickel. This is Deep Blue on BYU Radio. Welcome back to the Deep Blue Podcast. My name is Jason Shepherd. Happy to be joined by Nate Mickel. And Nate, before the break, you had just gotten home from your mission to Chile, and you'd mentioned it earlier in the podcast. You go to Snow College, but then you end up at BYU. How did you come to be in Provo?
Yeah, a couple of things. So we have to go back just a little bit. I kind of mentioned this like doubt, belief, obsession. And I go to Ricks and I think like, okay, I'm good enough to play at Ricks, but then I blow out my knee. And then I'm kind of wondering like, well, I think I'm good enough, but I never played. So I still remember I'm in Iquique, Chile. So I've been out for about a year and a half on my mission and, or maybe it would have been about a year. But my dad is sending me newspaper clippings from the BYU football team and they're crushing it. This is the 2001 season. Luke Staley, Brandon Doman, Spencer Need. And he's sending me these newspaper clippings. And one, I'm really homesick. But two, it's like I played with Spencer Need. He was my teammate at Ricks. And Anthony Ward, defensive lineman, and Justin Anderson, receiver. He was my host when I went to Ricks on my one recruiting trip that I had. And Pat Williams, wide receiver, and Mike Sumko, corner. And I played with these guys. So that day, I still remember walking around Iquique. It was one of the most homesick days of my life, but it was also one of the most exciting days of my life because it was the first time where I really believed, like, I can do this. I really think I can get to BYU. So I go to Snow College, and my freshman year, I do fine. I did okay my freshman year. Sophomore year, I'm excited. I'm gonna take it to the next level. First game, I have like 150 yards, a couple touchdowns. Next game, 100 yards. Next game, 100 yards. I was running back at the time, but also playing a little receiver. Aaron Roderick was my running back coach my freshman year. And then I bust my ankle. I don't break it, but I sprain it so bad that I'm out for 2 months. Come back, and in warmups, I'm running a route, slip, tear my meniscus. So I basically missed my whole sophomore season. And A-Rod's now at SUU. I'm like, can I come play there? He's like, well, yeah, you can walk on, but like, you know, I you don't have any film that I can show the guys. We can't give you a scholarship. Paul Tidwell's son, Cy, was a good friend of mine at Snow. And so Paul called me and said, you know, I've seen you play a couple times before you got hurt. We'd love to have you come walk on. So end up trying out at BYU. I couldn't do 225 on the bench. I was coming off knee surgery. I was 195 pounds. I ended up playing at BYU at 175. So I'm 25 pounds heavier than I should have been. I run a 4.940. And I think my career's over because at the walk-on tryout, I'm so weak and I'm so slow. And I go look at, and in fact, I called my friends and I was like, well, after the tryout, I was like, my football career's over. I'm done. I'm not going to make the team. I ran a 4.9. I'm a 195 pound running back that's not that fast and not that big and strong. And so anyway, I remember go looking at the list and my name is on the list that I make the team. And I walk into Paul Tidwell's office and he literally smacks me on the head. And he says, a 4.940, you know, you didn't even do 225. And I'm like, coach, I'm sorry. Coming off knee surgery. I won't let you down. I promise. So he gives me a chance. And I still remember what was kind of cool too is, you know, my freshman year, when I was at Ricks, I'm watching BYU on TV and I'm seeing Fahu Tahi. He was my class. He's a freshman playing, you know, I'm like, man, Fahu Tahi, Luke Staley. And then I see Curtis Brown over the next, you know, while I'm at Snow, I remember making the team. And then that very first day, there's like six running backs. It's like Fahu, Curtis, I think Bryce Mawika was there, Moa, like there's like, was it Waylon and me? And I'm like, holy crap, how did I get in this room? I'm sitting in this room with these guys that I never thought I could be here. And so just such a cool moment where I find myself in the room with guys that I looked up to so much.
Well, you had mentioned that, you know, while you're on your mission, you're getting all of these updates on how great the 2001 team was. And obviously things were great within the program in 2001. But when you joined, from a win-loss perspective, things were not like they were in 2001. In 2005, the team goes 6-6. But in 2006, the team makes a jump to 11-2. How did you guys make that jump from the 2005 season to the 2006 season with that big of an increase?
Yeah, so going back to one of my very first meetings when I was a walk-on, my walk-on, what would that have been? My junior year, but didn't count, redshirt junior year. In a team meeting, one of the team captains stands up. The program's a mess. There's been, guys are getting kicked out for sexual assault and robbery. And we have a players only meeting. And one of the guys, he's the leader on the team, stands up and says, "Guys, how can you be so stupid to get caught drinking? Stop getting caught drinking. You got to be so dumb to get caught." And I was like, wow, this is not what I expected. And so Bronco comes in, and Gary Croton was the coach at the time. And I love Gary. And I think anybody who's played for Gary loves Gary, but for whatever reason, he just, the team wasn't doing what he was expecting. And so Bronco comes in and a lot of guys quit and he cleaned house, and Robert and I comes in super hard nosed. And then we just had a lot of players that put in the work and we're good. John Beck, Cameron Jensen, Johnny Harling, Curtis Brown, Jake Caressa. I mean, we had some guys, Brian Keel, Dave Nixon, Ben Criddle. So we had just a lot of good players. We had a lot of good coaches. We got Fooey. I mean, just at every position, we had guys that could make plays. So yeah, we go 11-2 and end up, you know, in 2005, we lost in the bowl game to a Berkeley team that had this running back who was pretty good, but we didn't know how good, but he had three touchdowns and it was Marshawn Lynch. And then the other guy they had was a pretty good receiver. He scored a touchdown right before half, just on a little out route, made a guy miss, ran 70 yards, DeSean Jackson. But the senior year team, we only lose two games, one to a double overtime loss to Matt Ryan at Boston College. Another one was at Nick Folks, the kicker, Arizona, kicks like a 55-yard field goal. Those are only two losses. In the bowl game, we play Arizona with Jonathan Stewart, Dennis Dixon. We beat them by 30. I had a really good team, a lot of good players, a lot of good coaches.
Well, and speaking of, you mentioned Bronco has taken some heat over the last couple of years from people that thought, well, maybe he was a little more spiritual than he needed to be as the head coach. But I have always appreciated that side of Bronco, because Bronco is going to be Bronco regardless if you want it or not. He is always going to be true to himself, and that's who he is. And in hearing you talk about everything that was going on, how needed was that in the program at the time with everything that Bronco brought in and installed?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because you could imagine Bronco coming in under different circumstances and he takes a slightly different approach, where he maybe doesn't have to lean in quite as hard to the religious side of things. But look, it's BYU, it's a religious school. And I just think Bronco, he's not a guy that's just kind of half in. Like, he's an all or nothing kind of guy. And so look, if it's a religious school, then we're going to talk about religion, and it's going to be a part of this, and it's going to be, we're going to turn it into a competitive advantage. And, you know, I ate it up, and I think most of us did, especially given where we were. Again, under different circumstances, maybe it would have, you know, maybe he wouldn't have leaned in that hard, or maybe we wouldn't have been thirsting for it, but it was just perfect fit at the perfect time for us.
Your playing career at BYU comes to an end. You've already mentioned all of the things that you've done post BYU, but go back to that moment when you realized that your playing days were done. What are you thinking at that time?
Oh, well, one, I wanted to play in the NFL, but I'd pulled my hamstring like off and on, different, you know, each side 10 or 15 times the last offseason, between some pretty severe pulls and minor tweaks, everything in between. So I was like, well, I guess I'm done. I'd met my Keisha Thorne, who I would end up marrying, 7 months after graduating, and she was a cougarette and didn't want, and she really wanted to keep dancing at BYU and finish school. She was a civil engineer. I wanted her to graduate. So part of me wanted to go play. I felt like I could. I felt like I was a poor man's version of Wes Welker, but Wes Welker was one of the best wide receivers in the NFL, and I didn't need to be that, but I felt like I could have been a good, you know, third down guy or slot receiver. But ultimately, it was like, well, I had a good run. I'd way rather stay here with Keisha than even try to pursue something or be long distance from her. So I got a job there in Provo, and we were living right across from the practice facility. And so my job was pretty flexible at the time. I would go over to practice quite a bit. And it was there that I run into Greg Wrubell. And I knew Greg a little bit, but not great. We, you know, he'd interviewed me a couple times. And then he asked me that question of, you know, would you want to be the sideline reporter? And he says, you'll go to all the games and we'd pay for you to go to all the games. And I was like, well, I don't even need to think about it. Yes. I mean, let me go talk to Keisha, but absolutely. I called a few people. Some of them said, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't do it because it might ruin your relationship with Bronco. You know, the relationship he has with the media. And I was like, I don't care. This is such a good opportunity. And not that I don't care about my relationship with Bronco, but I think I can do it in a way that I can still maintain my relationship with Bronco and be a part of the program. And so that leads to another, just, it ended up being three seasons. I go to law school for two. I ended up coming back my third year of law school, and just an absolute life highlight to get to know you. And then of course, work with Greg and Mark and all of the KSL IMG people and go into all those incredible games for the next 10 years.
I can't think of anybody better qualified to answer this question than you. So I'm very curious your thoughts on this. The perception of the academic world is that academics and religion do not mix. So as someone who is devout in his religious beliefs and also highly educated and in academia, how do you live and thrive in both worlds, which would seem to be at odds with each other?
Yeah, you know, a number of different church leaders have said something to the effect of, like, bring us all the truth. You know, I think Joseph Smith said it, like, look, we're just interested in the truth wherever it is. And that's all we want. So as a, you know, as an academic in the social sciences, we're just trying to find truth. We're trying to generate new knowledge. But having grown up religious and seeing so many of the benefits that religion has provided me, I just feel like there's so much truth there. I mean, I feel like, so some of, one of the things I do in my research is, this is a project I'm working on right now. We look at people's the frames or the frameworks that they view the world through. So if you tell a business person, just, you know, make a business decision, give them a task and have them make a business decision, they'll make a certain decision. But tell somebody to make an ethical decision, and if they view that decision through an ethical frame, then they end up making a more honest, generous, ethical decision. Well, of course, the irony here is that ethical business decision is not, these are not mutually exclusive terms, right? I mean, we should always be making ethical business decisions. But when you adopt a frame, like a business frame, then you just tend to be more greedy and dishonest compared to when you adopt an ethics frame. And I've just been thinking about this in terms of my life. I feel like religion has provided such a great frame for, it's like in my mind, it's a great operating system. If somebody harms you, forgive them. If you screw up, repent. Ask for forgiveness. You know, live your life in a way that you're going to be proud, not just at the end of your life, but we have faith there's an afterlife. So I heard a phrase years ago, and it said, all self-help boils down to long-term thinking. And if you think about it, you know, it's like drinking alcohol. What's that? That's borrowing happiness from the future. So if you don't drink alcohol, if you're thinking long-term, you're not going to drink alcohol. You're not going to take drugs. And then, you know, so I've had this, like, this has been running through my head for years. You know, all self-help is long-term thinking. And then you hear General Conference a couple weeks ago, and President Monson is saying, think celestial. And it was like, wow, I've been thinking long-term a lot. But I love how President Nelson says, you know, don't just think about, you know, it's great to think long-term in this life, but let's think long-term in the eternities. And now you're really going to make some good decisions. And so for me, I don't feel like the secular world has a lot of great answers for what kind of life to live. I feel like I see so many people in society who think, you know, if you get your kid into Harvard, like that's your metric for success. And I just think so often that an overemphasis on the status that a Harvard or a Princeton or a Yale would provide is just so often not worth the cost to me. And so I feel like from my perspective, the religion that my parents taught me, that I believe in, that I have faith in, it's the best operating system for me. The way I do think about it though, is it is a choice. And I forget the, this is an original idea to me, but it's like, look, faith is a choice, because if the evidence were so overwhelmingly obvious that God exists, then there is no choice to make. It's like, well, if you know God lives in, why would you choose the opposite? And so in order for there to be a choice, there has to be competing evidence on each side. Otherwise, there is no real choice. And so I do believe faith is a choice. Now, some people argue very strongly that having faith is a bad choice. People like Sam Harris, who I listen to and respect, and I think he's very smart and thoughtful. But ultimately, for me, I've made the choice to believe, and I feel like when I just feel like I get constantly rewarded over and over again for that choice. And then aside from all the benefits that I get, just all of the moments that I felt what I believe is the Holy Ghost prompting me on this path, it's like it kind of gets to the point where, well, there is no choice. Like, now I'm just so committed. Now I still screw up and I'm weak and, you know, it's like still mess up, but I made the choice and the benefits to me are so clear and the confirmations have been so strong that I'm committed. And I think it was Brigham Young that said something like, never say you'll never leave the church, because you don't know that, and you don't have any control over that yourself. You know, it's like, it's only because of the mercy of God and his grace that we're able to do anything. And so I try to be humble about it, but I don't see myself ever leaving. And I believe as long as I have faith, I will just keep seeing the blessings that come from that.
Nate, one last question before we wrap things up. What's the next chapter in the story of Nate Mickle look like to you?
Yeah. So one thing I've realized about my life is my body deteriorates more and more every day. I feel like I am really leaning into my mind. Like I go back to when I was a child, I've always loved to learn. And I was asked this question recently, like, what is the point of your life? And I feel like for me right now, it's learn and share. Like I love to learn. And then I just want to share the things I learn with others. And so that's why I'm a professor. I get to teach students. And I had this idea a few years ago to start a podcast where I would collect, like, share the lessons that I most wanted to pass on to my kids. I record these little audio journals for them. Then I started thinking, like, I'll interview other people and hear what they want to pass on. And so a couple of years ago, I started this podcast, Mickles and Dimes, which is now just my most favorite hobby, because I just talk to people I respect and admire and who are interesting and ask them, of all the things you've learned, what would you most want to pass on? So President Reese and Bronco and Steve Young and just on and on. So that's what I do besides teach and besides research, where I try to generate new knowledge, and besides spending time with my family and besides playing video games, which I still absolutely love and could play for 24 hours a day every day if I didn't have other demands of my time. And I love spending time with my family. But in terms of professional life, it's learning, it's reading, it's interviewing people, and then just sharing it with others through my podcast.
Nate, it's a pleasure to be able to talk with you. I have enjoyed this conversation immensely. I really do appreciate you taking a few minutes. It was so great to be able to get to see you when we were out in Lawrence. And I'm for many reasons, I am thrilled that BYU is in the Big 12. But if it means there's more opportunities to see Nate Mickle, it makes the situation even better. Thank you so much for doing this, man. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. I have, you know, it's just like endless gratitude in my heart for BYU and all the people I met there. And I really think I may be the most excited person about BYU to the Big 12, because my KU world gets to merge with my BYU world. And I get to see you and all of the BYU fans and family and friends out here multiple times a year now. So thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you once again to my guest, Nate Mickle. My name is Jason Shepherd. Ben Hall and Josh Bergstrom produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.